I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
What do you call a walking hospital?
We're leeches named after doctors.
And what is the nocebo effect?
We'll diagnose disease names, define some drugs, explore the influence of influenza, and find out the origins of obstetrics on this medical episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. Welcome to a new season, indeed. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are getting surgical with language and talking about medicine and drugs and all the vivisection of the living language that we speak.
Oh, God, that's such a grim word, isn't it, vivisection?
Oh, yeah, it's horrible. The practice, too.
Yeah, we're going to be exploring medical words, medical places, medical people, medical conditions, and medical cures as well. The origins of
those words.
The gnarly
fun ones in particular.
Yeah, those two. There's going to be bits and bobs of medical Latin, a little Greek in there. That's, this stuff all comes up. But also, it's not going to be all that, because I know that can get, you know, that can get a bit heavy. Don't worry about it. But where should we start, Jess? Let's just get straight stuck into it.
We should start with the name of the practitioners of medicine, because this has been quite a journey. We call them doctors today, right? But a doctor was not what we would call a doctor originally.
Yeah, that's right.
And in fact, the Old English word for a doctor was not a doctor at all, but a leech, as yeah. We have mentioned before.
We have. There are all kinds of insulting names for doctors. On there.
Leech was not insulting originally. It meant an enchanter or a healer or a physician, someone who treated illnesses through herbs and salves or charms or cauterization or minor surgical work. And it's thought they were not called leeches because they used leeches. Leeches were named perhaps after doctors or perhaps from a completely different source that then merged because doctors used leeches.
That is a heck of a revelation. So leeches might be named after doctors, not doctors named after leeches. And also the word doctor itself, right? It exists as an academic title really before it exists as the person that does medical stuff. You might think of it as the other way around, but it speaks to the nature of doctors as academic beings primarily, and then eventually, you know, the practice of medicine starts to become a very hands-on practice, and they are the healers.
The root means to teach, and then physicians, an earlier word for what we might call a doctor now, and still a word for what we might call a doctor now, originally from a root meaning nature. A physician diagnosed in the medieval era illnesses, and they prescribed drugs and typically had university training.
And it wasn't necessarily a respectable profession.
Oh, yeah, no. They were people who dealt in bodily fluids and stuck their hands in people and whatnot.
Yeah, you get really dirty, wouldn't you? But if leech isn't an insulting name for a physician, there have been insulting names
for
physicians. And we're not talking even that far back, right? We're talking the sort of 16th, 17th, 19th centuries. You know, now to be a doctor is a job to aspire to, you know.
Yes.
It wasn't then, was it?
it depended on what you needed done too. So if you needed to see someone for, if you were wealthy and needed to see someone for an illness, you might go to someone who was a respected physician. But if you just needed to get a tooth pulled or something, you might go to the barber, or you might get one of your medical remedies from the local mountebank who performed in public marketplaces, which, by the way, that means climb onto a bench, because this is a person who sold like snake oils and whatnot from their bench in a local marketplace.
And you've mentioned the tie-in between barbers and a surgery, essentially, right? It's one of those facts that everyone likes to, I don't know, it feels like a middle-aged dad fact, you know, at parties about, you know, the symbol outside of a hairdresser's, the barber's pole with the red wrapping around it is a bloody bandage, I think is the story goes.
Yeah, so supposedly a bandage around the arm of someone who has been bled at the barber.
I didn't know about the arm bit. That's a bit more grim than I was grim enough.
They mostly did bloodletting and dentistry. And so like if you were thought to have poor humors, you might go to the barber for a little bloodletting to make you feel better, of course. Because who needs more blood when they're feeling ill?
Yeah, it's true. A lot of sort of chair-based surgeries.
Yes, indeed. The barber too. A lot of people want barber to be related to words like barbarian, but it really just means bearder. It's from a Latin word for beard. So, you know, their primary job was still hair.
I did also look up some old terms for surgeons. So, you know how surgeons are called Mr. and doctors are called Doctor? Right, as in like their titles.
I actually didn't know that.
Okay, well, it might just be in Britain. I don't even know if it's the same in the States.
But I didn't think that was the case. I thought surgeons were doctors.
Well, it is the case in the UK that often if you have a surgeon, their title will not be doctor, it will be mister. And that is a relic of the fact that surgeons were not particularly respected profession for quite a long time. You know, to the point where they were just referred to as Mr. And now it's actually worn almost as a sort of badge of honor in itself to be a Mr. rather than a doctor in that context. But some old words for surgeons. You have manmender, which was used in the 17th
I like that
century,
one.
Which I rather like. Flesh tailor, which is another 17th century one. That's grim.
That's horrible.
Flesh tailor. Yeah, I know. There's something sort of leather face about it, isn't
there? Oh, yeah.
I think we mentioned Nim Gimmer before, which was also used for doctors at times. And it's not,
can you remind me what that means?
Well, it's not entirely known, but it's thought that the nim at the start might be that really old English word for take. Before we took the word take from Old Norse, from the Vikings, the verb in English was niman, right? So to nim something is to take it. So it's possibly, you know, we're talking about how a surgeon means sort of someone who works with their hands on someone, takes them in hand. So the idea of, you know, nimming something is taking it in the hand. So it might be that. And the gimmer is just sort of a something to make it sort of bouncy and sort of insulting. And then it's this old word scarifier that we don't use anymore, which means someone who scratches at things. It's very similar to like the word scar, although I'm not actually sure if it is related to the word scar now I think about it. But that was in use in the 16th century.
That would make sense to me if it were related to scar.
The idea of scratching and scarring are obviously very similar.
This isn't specific to surgeons, but if you were a fraudulent or unqualified medical practitioner, you might be called a quack as early as the 17th century. And it is a shortening of quacksalver, which is from a Middle Dutch element meaning to brag or boast, plus like salve as an ointment. So someone who brags or boasts about their ointments is a quacksalver or a quack.
Yeah, so some dodgy individuals involved and also some very dodgy cures. You've been looking up some medicines of the past.
I do. First of all, I would love to talk about the origin of the term drug. It just means dry. It's Germanic in origin and it might simply mean dry thanks to phrases like drogevatte, which means like dry barrels, or drogvara, meaning dry wares, both described like shipping items, including drugs, but also spices and herbs and any other kind of medicinal substance. It is an interesting trait of Indo-European languages that substances meant to cure people, to get them high or to kill them, all share overlapping names. Like we already know that this is true of drug, which is a word for a medicine and an intoxicant, but also potion and poison, which are etymological doublets, also indicated, and same with venom, meant medicine, drug, ointment, like all kinds of good and bad things at the same time.
A potion could be a benevolent poison.
Yes.
They're both poisons.
Pharmacy, similarly, is from a Greek root that could mean a preparer of drugs or a poisoner. So it could mean both medicine, but also poison, charm, or enchantment too. And then same with venom. Nowadays, venom and poison are slightly different. If you're envenomated, it's under the skin. Poison is by mouth. But originally, also both a good and a bad thing.
Yeah, that's a key difference, isn't it? A snake is venomous because it injects you with a poison, right? Something poisonous, you've eaten it.
If we're going to look more toward the modern era, I do think it's worth mentioning vaccine, because the origin of this word is it's well known, but it means from cows. It was to prevent people from getting smallpox by giving them a small dose of cowpox. Edward Jenner was credited with developing the vaccine, but there were lots of other people who experimented with the same idea before him, including Benjamin Jesty, who inoculated his family. We had words like inoculation or variolation, which involved scratching material from smallpox sores into your arm. But this was also risky because you could also just end up with a really bad case of smallpox.
They're all quite bad.
Right. I mentioned variolation. Variola was another word for smallpox, and it means speckled or spotted. And then inoculate means to implant a bud into another plant originally, and then was extended to vaccines. But as for other exciting drugs from the past, I have ether, which was originally a word for space juice. It's a Greek-derived word. It means to burn or to shine. But dialing back to ancient cosmology, ether was a word for the fifth element filling space beyond the moon, treated as a pure form of fire or air. But then in the 1600s to the 1800s, we had it as this hypothetical medium or luminiferous ether, thought to carry light or forces through space. But there was an 1887 experiment based in optics that compared the speed of light in different directions as Earth moved through space, seeking evidence of this ether wind, and it failed to show the expected difference. So the ether medium kind of fell out of use until in the 1700s, ether became the name for a volatile chemical compound known earlier for its lightness and its lack of color, and was used as an anesthetic in the 1840s.
So is it called ether because it may as well be air?
Because it's light and has a lack of color, and perhaps because it sends you into a metaphorical ether.
Oh yeah, I like that. Yeah,
that
like
certainly that. Didn't hurt its usage in that capacity. Before I continue, did you bring any drugs to this discussion?
I never leave the house without drugs. No, this is not true. Oh, that's exactly the sort of sentence that AI is going to trawl this video for and get us demonetized for. I apologize.
Fortunately, you are at home though, so.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. Where I keep all of my drugs. No, stop. I didn't bring any drugs, Jess, but I did bring a placebo.
Oh, a drug that works but shouldn't.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if we've done this one before. We might have done it. If we did, it was a long time ago. So
I don't remember.
If you've heard me explain this before, then you are one of the true dedicated fans of Words Unraveled, because you must have been here from pretty much the start. But placebo, so it's Latin for I will please. Why is it called that? Because it's a pill that is going to please your patient, whatever. You give it to them, or a pill or, you know, any treatment really that is done for the sake of just pleasing the patient, not actually curing them. But the word had usage before its medical usage. It's really interesting because it was used in funeral rites, Christian funeral rites. And you have a ceremony that is called the placebo. Right. Yeah. But the reason it's called the placebo is that placebo is the first word of one of the chants.
Oh.
Placebo domino in regione vivorium, which means I shall please the Lord in the land of the living. Right. So to say placebo was to basically give a sort of a funeral rite. It was to read the psalms associated with the dead. But there's another psalm that's associated with the dead from the same, essentially the same psalm book from the same collection of ceremonial pronouncements. And that one was called the dirige or the dirige, because the first line of the psalm was Dirige Domine Deus Meus in conspectu tuo viam meam, which means directs me, O Lord, my God, my way in thy sight. That's not that important. But what is important is that that ceremony is called the Dirige. But it's from that we get the word dirge, because dirge is a corruption of dirige or dirige. Yeah, so I thought I'd mention that. Obviously, that's nothing to do with drugs, but it's just such an elegant link between the words placebo and dirge. They both come about as because these words are the first words in a line from a psalm from a funeral.
Well, if your placebo effect does not take effect, then you might end up having people sing a dirge over you when you die.
It's true.
There we go. You mentioned the first word in that, which means to direct, is also the root of dirigible, which we have talked about before, a directable balloon.
Well, yeah, and of direct as well. Yeah. And it's the French word dirige, means direct as well. But have you heard of, Jess, the nocebo effect?
I have.
So I'll explain it anyway for those who haven't, because I haven't. This is basically when your own negative view on whether or not something is going to work means that it doesn't work, basically, or your own pessimistic view of your prognosis actually makes the outcome worse. It's called the nocebo effect. I mean, the word placebo goes back a very, very long way. There's 1200s, 1300s in the English language, but the nocebo effect only goes back to, it's from the 1900s. It's from the 1960s. There's a quote from 1961. It is somewhat surprising that little attention has been drawn to the existence of the contrary effect, contrary to placebo, that is, which I may call the nocebo reaction. Which, by the way, sounds like a rubbish portmanteau of no and placebo.
Yeah.
But it actually isn't.
Oh, really?
It's from a Latin verb. Genuinely, it is Latin for I will harm. Huh. Nocebo.
I genuinely thought it was just like a stupid variation on placebo, but that makes more sense.
it's totally legit as, it's from nocere, which is Latin for to harm.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Let's talk about some narcotics, which narcotic, it's from a Greek root meaning numbness or deadness or stupor. And by the way, narc as in a police informer and narc as in the shortening of narcotic are not ultimately related, but they heavily overlap in meaning and usage. So the word narc is a word for a police informer, shows up in the 1800s and is thought to be related to a Romani word for a nose. And then narc with a C, meanwhile, is short for narcotics agent. But thanks to the context, its usage almost certainly influenced the usage of the word narc, as in snitch. But one famous narcotic from back in the day is laudanum, which entered English around 1600. It's either from laudere, meaning to praise, or it's from a Latinized Greek term for gum resin. The interesting thing about this is that it was coined by Paracelsus or Paracelsus. Somebody's going to have to correct me on that one.
That's interesting. Well, actually, so the next stop on the U-Bahn from where I live is called Paracelsus Bad.
Okay, all right.
So it's pronounced in German Paracelsus.
Okay.
But that's because they pronounce Caesar's S. So actually, I haven't helped you there.
That makes sense, though, because he's Swiss. So that helps.
It's Paracelsus.
He is sometimes called the father of toxicology, and his full name was Philippus Aureolus Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim, which Really, I feel like he should have just kept the whole thing. But he used laudanum as the name for a medicine he mixed, which was thought to be useful because it had things like gold and crushed pearls in it, but it was probably just because it had loads of opium in it. Speaking of opium, it basically just means plant juice, specifically poppy juice. Mm, yeah. We also attach oid to it, which is kind of neat. It's like it's poppy-like or plant juice-like stuff with that oid ending on it.
Right. So would opium not actually be opioid? We've talked about things with oid being not the thing that they claim to be, but something like the thing they claim to be, which would mean that opium was not an opioid.
Right, because humanoid.
But things that are like opium are opioid.
Well, it's debatable, right? It's like asteroids are called asteroids because they're star-shaped, but not actually stars. Humanoid, you're human-shaped. You may or may not be human. So
yeah. Yeah, debatable. Exactly. Factoids, some people think they're cute little facts, but really, it's supposed to be like something that's not quite a fact.
Right. It's more like fake news, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But another one here, morphine, is named after Morpheus. I had trouble coughing that up.
I think it came up in our Greek mythology episode.
It did. It did. Yes. The god of dreams, of course. And then heroin is a bit of an interesting one. The Greek basis of the word heroin is indeed the same one that gave us the word hero, but the ending is not thought to be the feminine ending seen in heroin with an E. Rather, much like the ending of cocaine, which I'll get to in a second, the ending of the drug heroin is most likely a spin on the chemical ending ene that we also see in morphine.
But it doesn't have an E on the end of it, the drug, right? So it is in, but it's like, yeah, it's a deliberate pun, isn't it, on the word heroin?
So it was coined by Friedrich Bayer and company, which is now just Bayer, the predecessor to that modern day pharma giant.
Yeah, again, they're about 2 meters away down the road.
Oh.
Humongous bioplant.
It is almost certainly, as you've said, a portmanteau of heroin, but also more heroine, the hero, the female hero, and morphine. So a drug that comes to your healing rescue when you're in pain. So yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
As for cocaine, the name predates this by a good bit. This, of course, dates back to like pre-1500s indigenous people in the Andes Mountains who chewed coca leaves for energy. And it was first isolated in 1855 as the modern drug and then refined to make the alkaloid cocaine, cocaine, essentially, which is interesting. It's meant to echo the even earlier morphine.
Echo. It's nice you mentioned Echo, another character from Greek myth.
But, yes, indeed.
Yeah, the original.
It was famously added to tonics, medicines, early Coca-Cola, which was named after it. Coca wine was big and popular back in the day. It was both a wine that you could sip and a patent medicine, particularly Mariani wine, created in the 1860s by Angelo Mariani, who was a French chemist from Corsica.
Yeah, I think Coca-Cola exists because someone wanted to create a coca wine that wasn't a wine.
I looked up the DEA's list of street names for cocaine, and it has almost 500 different street names. I won't go into all of them, but some are obvious and familiar, like the Devil's Dandruff or Reindeer Dust or Snow White. And some of them are really obscure and niche, and I don't understand them, like Henry VIII ski equipment and pantaloons.
Henry VIII ski equipment.
Henry VIII, comma, ski equipment. These are all different names. Not Henry. I mean,
he was into a lot of sports. He maybe went skiing.
By the way, I won't go too far into non-like street drugs, which we can address a different time. But psychedelic is a little interesting. Not that it's that much of a revelation etymologically, but it was coined in 1956 by Canadian psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond, who experimented with mescaline and LSD. And the word literally describes the sensation of tripping, meaning to reveal in the mind. The first recorded use of the word also has an interesting literary connection because Osmond first used it in a letter to Aldous Huxley, author of the dystopian sci-fi classic Brave New World. Huxley wrote to Osmond to ask about his research, and Osmond provided Huxley with a dose of mescaline and observed his experience. And Huxley would go on to write the book, The Doors of Perception, based on his experience.
Fascinating stuff. I think the episode's got a bit druggy.
Yeah,
Jess, so I think there's a good chance of us getting demonetized for all of this street talk of reindeer dust.
It's all history and education, brah.
Yeah. It's me that's going to have to appeal it with the bloody YouTube, though.
We should talk about the things that they cure, the things that these drugs cure.
That is a great idea. Yeah, I'm very up for that. I was looking up, if I may, some more unusual diseases, or at least more unusual disease names. Now, actually, you remember when we had Joshua Blackburn on? He tested us on some real or fictional diseases.
Yes.
You correctly identified that exploding head syndrome is indeed a disease, which is, you know, it's hearing loud noises in your sleep. But you've got others like fish odor syndrome, which is not, you know, it's not a nice thing to have at all. It's when your body can't break down a certain compound found in some foods, you end up smelling a fish, fish odor syndrome. But here's a fascinating one. Have you heard of Stendhal syndrome?
No, what's that?
So Stendhal was a guy, okay, so he was a French author. His real name was Marie-Henri Bell, but he went by the name Stendhal. And he described going to Florence and seeing the tombs of Galileo, Machiavelli, and Michelangelo, and looking at all of the beautiful architecture and beautiful artwork in Florence, and suddenly feeling very sick. The way he describes it is, everything spoke so vividly to my soul. I could only forget. I had palpitations of the heart, what in Berlin they call nerves. Life was drained from me. I walked with a fear of falling. So this condition that's named after Stendhal syndrome, is the condition of fainting when you see something beautiful.
That's actually amazing.
this work is so gorgeous, I swooned.
That feels very like romantic poetry.
Oh, yeah.
Even like romantic era or early 1800s fiction. Like even in Frankenstein, there are several scenes where Dr. Frankenstein just like goes out and like is overwhelmed by the power of nature.
It's very much one of those. But keep an eye out for it. And if you ever find yourself in Florence, just beware. Very beautiful place. And also one more that I wanted to mention was walking corpse syndrome, which
that
is also known as
real and scary.
Yeah. It's also known as Cotard's syndrome. And it's the delusional belief that you are dead already, or that you are decomposing, or that you've had your organs removed. But what I found interesting about it is that this manifests in two ways in the mind. About half of patients think that the fact that they are dead means that they've never existed, right? So they have this sort of delusion of never having existed. But the other half interpret it as meaning that they are immortal, right? And that they, for example, can have all of their blood removed and all of their organs removed, and they still continue to live, which is obviously very dangerous. Thinking you are immortal is an incredibly dangerous state of mind to be in. And yeah, that's known as walking corpse syndrome.
Have you heard of auto brewery syndrome?
It sounds like just like someone who makes beer in their car.
In their gut, actually. So it's called auto brewery syndrome.
Yeah.
There's like fungi present in your gut that turns carbohydrates into alcohol. So if you have a particular type of fungus growing in you, you can make beer in your body.
Yeah. I mean, you've got fermentation happening inside of you, right? And it can result in people getting drunk.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously having drunk any alcohol because it's being formed inside of them and it's finding its way into the bloodstream. It's obviously very serious, probably.
Primarily, it makes you feel like you're hungover even when you're not or haven't had anything. There's also foreign accent syndrome. If there is damage to a certain part of your brain that affects speech and language, you can occasionally wake up with from a stroke or some kind of trauma with a different accent.
It's incomprehensible to me, that one. I cannot get my head around it. I know there are like documented cases of it, but how? I just don't understand how it can be possible.
You cannot get your head around it.
I can't get my head around this. Foreign accent syndrome. I don't know what accent that was. But I mean, you know, to develop an accent, you have to grow up around people speaking a certain way. It creates physiological changes in how the organs of your mouth and your vocal tract work. How can you wake up one day with a different accent unless you wake up one day pretending to have a different accent?
I wonder if it existed before modern media where you had ready exposure to people with other accents.
They're just speaking a different way, and it correlates very closely to another accent. I don't know.
There's also one of the silliest like medical ailments that I love from history is bicycle face. Of course, it only impacted women, apparently. Like if you rode a bicycle, which was a very unladylike thing to do, you might get bicycle face.
What are the symptoms?
Your face gets uglier because you ride a bicycle.
This is like the wind changing, right?
And your
face stays like that. We mentioned the word symptom, by the way. Let's briefly just talk about words like symptom and diagnosis and prognosis. So symptom is things that happen at the same time, right? That's what's interesting about the word symptom, is there's no actual cause and effect implied by the word itself. And we talk about something being a symptom of a condition, but what it actually means is it occurs at the same time as it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was caused by it. So I think that's quite an interesting distinction there. And then diagnosis and prognosis, the gnosis at the end of there is, you know, Greek for knowing things. Yeah, exactly. So to prognosticate.
Yes.
Yeah. Or your prognostication was an earlier word for prognosis. Actually, this is your prognostication. And it means, to know something in advance. And diagnosis is essentially to differentiate between two things, to know things apart.
We're doing a little etymological diagnosis, but not much prognostication.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully not too much.
Should we talk about some diseases like diseases that we still have today sometimes, but still have interesting and kind of unexpected names, like influenza?
Yeah, which is just Italian for influence, right?
Yeah, and not... Okay, so this is fun too. I like how serendipitous this one is, because it wasn't... Like you would think that flu is related to words for like flowing, because your nose and your throat tend to be flowing, but it's not. It's nothing to do with that. It's the influence of the stars.
It's amazing, isn't it? I love it when things... We had this moment with ether as well, how just something that seems very specific actually has these enormous universal implications.
It was originally a word for any kind of epidemic in Italian, same in Latin, late Latin as well. And that's where like it's a little less medical and a little more mystical. It implies the influence of the stars with their positions causing both ill fortune and illness. So any bad thing.
It's like a disaster then, right? One of our favorite etymologies.
I guess this one isn't that much of a revelation, but I do think it's interesting that consumption used to mean any kind of wasting disease, any kind of emaciation, which makes sense. It's something that consumes you, and consumption, of course, being the older word for tuberculosis, which was made more specific and medical over time. And tuberculosis, I always figured that it had to do with like something wrong with your tubes.
Oh, yeah. Tuberculosis of the tube.
Right. But it's more to do with your tubers, your swellings and pimples and lumps.
As in like potatoes are swellings under the ground.
And it's referring to the what do you call them?
Glands?
Lymph nodes?
Oh, the lymph nodes.
Sure. Glands. Did you know the origin of the word mump? As in mumps?
I mean, I always assumed it was like a lump, like the lumps that you might get on your... Is that a mump?
Yes, it is the plural of mump, which began as a verb in the 1580s, meaning to whine or mutter like a beggar. And it's from a Dutch word meaning to cheat or deceive. But it also probably is like caught on because it involves visible facial swelling and a strained muttering mouth posture. So it's a little bit of both.
Okay, yeah. So it's sort of informed by the word lump.
Originally, it wasn't specific to the disease we call mumps now, but also meant a fit of melancholy or sullenness or silent displeasure. So like, you just have a grumpy face.
Silent displeasure.
If you had the mumps, you could just be grump. Measles, that one actually is just a word for like spotty stuff, blemishes and whatnot.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. So every one of those little spots is a measle. And that's what we call them, I suppose, isn't it?
The Middle English measle meant leprous. It was an adjective meaning a person with leprosy. We've also got gout. It's from a French word for a drop or a bead, which I thought was interesting. We've talked about humorism before, like the juices in your bodies being all funky. And gout was thought to be drops of viscous humors seeping into your joints, causing swelling and pain, which is a similar notion to the word dropsy, which is a morbid accumulation of watery liquid in your body.
I know all these Victorian diseases.
Also, did you know that rabies is related to the word rage?
Yes.
They are both from the Latin rabere, meaning to be mad or to rave. In earlier forms of English, it was also called rabies, yeah. But it was also called, as we know, hydrophobia too, and the rage, things like that. Yeah. Okay. It was interesting, the shift away from hydrophobia, which sounds more medical, right? But refers to the fact that, like, you literally cannot make yourself drink water sometimes if you have rabies. But it was also sometimes called aerophobia, meaning dread of air because it's hard to breathe, and pantophobia, meaning fear of all things because you're generally paranoid.
It's pretty horrible.
Rabies. Oh, no, it's terrible. It still has a ridiculously high mortality rate.
Yeah, yeah. If you're sitting there with it, go get yourself seen to, because the prognosis ain't usually very good. That's just a message to our rabid viewers.
No, rabid viewers.
You can see my cat at the back there. You're not rabid, are you?
Don't you put that evil on her.
She likes the light. I haven't brought any more diseases, but I know you've probably looked up some diseases that are going to make me blush, because this is how these things go.
Yeah.
I honestly thought we were safe on this episode, and then you've brought drugs, and I bet you're going to bring gonorrhea.
You thought in an episode about body juices that I wouldn't bring up any STDs. I have a whole chapter on this in Words from Hell.
It didn't have to be about body juices, Jess.
It's adjacent thematically.
So I think I know that the rhea bit in words like gonorrhea and diarrhea means to flow or something like that, right?
Diarrhea, gonorrhea, hemorrhoids, and rheumatism are all interestingly about rhythm, but also to flow. It's the same root as the word rhythm. And every other word, like, this is a very beautiful word, but basically every other word that is from that root means like some kind of schnassy flowing, because it also means flowing or stream. Words like diarrhea means flowing through, gonorrhea means flowing seed, and hemorrhoids means flowing blood, and rheumatism means just general drippy discharge. So that's very fun.
Oh, you know you're having a good time when the word discharge comes out. God. Although actually, when you're in hospital, a discharge is exactly what you're hoping for. So, yeah. I mean, at the end of it.
Did we talk before? We may have mentioned this before, but I think it's worth revisiting why gonorrhea is called the clap.
No, I don't know if we talked about that.
Oh, it's amazing. I love it. It's one of my favorites.
Shouldn't be. Go on.
It is from a French name for the disease, clapier-boubo, meaning an inflamed lymph node in the groin caused by visiting a clapier, literally a rabbit's nest, which was a euphemism for a brothel, because you would get the clap from the prolific sex lives of the rabbits in the rabbit's nest. The warren, you might say.
In the warren? The sex warren.
Speaking of which, we also have chlamydia, which is from a Greek root meaning a mantle or a military cloak, due to the fact that it cloaks the nucleus of an infected cell, which I think that's fairly scientific.
It's very scientific.
Herpes means creeping. It is a direct borrow from Greek. In Greek, herpes was a word for shingles, which is today called herpes zoster, which is Greek for belt or girdle, due to the common location of the disease.
to herpes, to like to creep.
Yeah. It's most frequently associated, obviously, with the STD or STI, now known as genital herpes, but it crops up in medical terminology for all kinds of skin conditions.
Yeah, and it's a really common thing. Like, oysters get herpes.
Yeah.
And you lose a whole sort of season of oysters.
It's not just like an STD thing. You can also have herpes virus in your mouth just without doing anything naughty.
Yeah. Cold sores, right.
And then syphilis. We should mention syphilis, which is named after the character Syphilis, who was the main character of the 1530 poem Syphilis, or the French disease. And in the poem, a shepherd shouts at the sun for being hot, and the sun responds by unleashing the venereal disease upon the world. So don't shout at the sun. There's a line from it that says, "With joints apart and flesh erased, thus was the shepherd flailed and thus debased." And the shepherd's name might be intended to literally mean pig lover. So
oh, nice.
That's fun.
And you mentioned it being known as the French disease, which I had always taken to be just kind of a slight by the English against their enemies. But it's not, actually.
No, it's like, from the poem.
I mean, it's called the French disease all over Europe, to friend and foe of the French. They all call it the French disease. Although I think partially because also a lot of Frenchmen caught it during the wars in Italy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you met someone with it, they're probably French.
Oh, I love it.
Although the French called it the Italian disease, which is probably a bit fairer, given as that tended to be where it was being picked up. I wanted to talk about medical establishments.
Ooh,
because
yeah.
we've mentioned the hospital quite a lot. I'd like to also talk about the different departments, because you can demystify some of the names, because one of the things about medicine is we use Greek and Latin to hide very, very literal descriptions. I've talked before about how German does not hide these literal descriptions, and sometimes you end up with horrible terms like mother mouth, meaning cervix. But luckily we do disguise it. Hospital. Anyway. Hospital. So hospital is the same word in all etymological senses as both hotel and hostel. Mm-hmm. Just sort of a longer version of it. Those are clipped versions of the word hospital, essentially, because they come from the same Latin hospitalis. It means a hostel.
A guest right? house.
It means somewhere that welcomes guests. Yeah, exactly. You know, originally, its use in English would refer to places where you would look after pilgrims or travelers or strangers, you know, that they would stay in a hospital. It may as well be a hostel. And then, of course, you've got the Order of the Knights Hospitaller, who set up in Jerusalem during the Crusades. And initially, they were just looking after pilgrims who, you know, basically didn't have enough money to find proper lodgings. But over the couple of centuries, they took on a more sort of protective role, accompanying these same pilgrims and then actually just sort of fighting on their behalves, which gives a bit of the swashbuckle to the idea of the knight. It's an interesting thing that I didn't know before. Sorry, and I'll stop in a sec. But the knight's hospitaller, I find it very difficult to pass that word. They went on to rule, to take control or to govern, that's the word, Rhodes and Malta. So the Maltese cross is actually the cross of the Knights Hospitaller when they were running the place. I thought, oh, that's interesting. So that's the cross that's on the Maltese flag, isn't it? And then I looked it up and no, the Maltese cross is not on the Maltese flag. There is a cross on the Maltese flag. The Maltese flag is a red bar next to a white bar. And in the corner, in the top left, there is a cross. But that cross is not the Maltese cross. It is the George Cross, the medal that was awarded to them by the king during the Second World War. So what is the cross on the Maltese flag? It is not the Maltese cross.
There's a lot of overlap between vexillology enthusiasts and etymology enthusiasts.
Yeah, so sort of historical geekery. Ambulance. Talk about ambulance.
Ambler.
Is the thing that takes you to hospital. The ambler. That is what it means. So we've just taken the word from French, and way more recently than you might think. It's from the French Revolutionary Wars. So, you know, we're only talking a couple of hundred years ago. We started using the word ambulance. And the ambulances to the French, les ambulances, were field hospitals. So the ambulance itself was the hospital. The word starts to be applied to the sort of little truck that gets you over there. But really what an ambulance is a mobile hospital. It's a walking hospital, as you rightly say.
It does not accurately describe the urgency of the situation. And I think German has it righter.
Which is just a sick car. Right, Krankenwagen. Yeah,
Krankenwagen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You don't want to amble over to the hospital. You want to get there a bit faster than that.
Right. Unless you're in New York traffic, in which case that's the only way you can get there.
One last one. Go on. Let me do one last one while we're talking about buildings. Clinic. Because I was wondering what clinic was that related to anything interesting, that word clinic? And it is. It's related to all words to do with sort of leaning over, incline, etc. Actually, the word lean itself.
Is it Because it was like, is it talking about a structure maybe, like on the side of something, like a lean-to?
It's not. It's talking about what you do when you're there, which is you lie down.
Oh, you lie down. I see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It comes from a Greek, it's actually a two-word Greek term, which was kliniki techni. That means bedside techni. What would that be? Like bedside practice? Sick bed practice is what the original word clinic meant, right? And it, yeah, so it means the place where you lie down and someone has a good look at you.
We have a lot of words with that were originally in Greek, something techni, the art of something, like cosmetic was originally part of, like, it was cosmetic-y techni, and critique was critique techni, things like that.
Oh, there you go. Another one for the list. And while we're patrolling the wards, then just let me just talk through some of the department names, because I think a few of them are sort of obvious. You know, I think people know that gynecology, gynae means woman, so it's the womany bit. That's the best I could come up with it.
I do like obstetric, if you'll indulge me. That one's really cool.
It's the midwifery department. Obstetrics literally means to stand opposite.
I love that the Latin word that predates this is obstetrix with an IX on the end, a woman who stands opposite the woman giving birth, much like the midwife is the person who stands with the woman.
There's this genuine semantic link between the word obstetrics and midwife, in the both just meaning the person that is with the woman, you know,
be the person
with
who
it or
catches.
Opposite. Catches the little baby. Yeah, exactly. Orthopedics is an interesting one. So we think of orthopedics as being all kinds of sort of manipulation, whatever, you know, your back. If you've got a bad back, you're going to see someone from orthopedics. But the pedics there is children, as you might expect, like pediatrics, because it was originally concerned with fixing, I don't like the word deformities, but that's kind of the way you would describe it, sort of childhood.
Probably things like rickets and polio.
But the ortho is quite interesting, because we get it in other words like...
Orthographic?
Orthographic, yeah. Mm-hmm. So ortho means right or correct. Hmm. So orthography is writing correctly.
So putting the children right.
It's exactly what it is. It is. It's correcting... Children,
right?
We're going to correct them. Orthopedics. In my newsletter recently, I did the etymology of orthodox, and dox is opinion, and orthodox is being of the right opinion. So we think of it as being, you know, conventional, but it doesn't actually mean conventional. It's way more judgmental than that. It is, if you're orthodox, it's you're doing it right.
Excellent.
I guess these are a little bit obvious, but if you don't know that, I suppose they're not. Like pathology is the study of disease or the study of suffering, even. So when, you know, you watch television and there's a pathologist poking around a dead body, the reason they've got that title is that they're looking for whatever it is that caused the death, what disease, what suffering caused the death. Because, you know, there are many types of pathologists that do not deal with dead people.
Speech pathologist addresses speech impediments and things like that.
Precisely. So you might come away from watching a lot of crime dramas thinking the pathologist only dealt with dead people, but it is not true. Psychiatry is the healing of the soul.
Ooh.
Quite interesting. It's the healing of the psyche. So you've got psychiatry on one side and neurology on the other, which is the sort of the study of the neurons, of the nerves, but more broadly the brain.
I would love to do an episode just on psychology terms, because many words that we use in common parlance today came from the era of like psychiatry and psychology.
Yeah, psychoanalysis has given us a lot of juicy stuff. We'll definitely get into that. Let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll do that one. That'll do for this episode. We talked a lot, been going for a long time. We learned a lot about drugs.
This has been a panacea, an etymological panacea.
Very good. Very good, Jeff. We'll catch you in another episode of Words Unraveled. What will we talk about then? Tune in to find out.
See you next time.